Hi everyone, thank you very much for the warm welcome. Thanks very much for being here. I know there's plenty of other interesting things to do, so I'm happy that some of you are interested to hear what I have to share. As already mentioned, I've been part of the Tor community for years, so I've been a relay operator for half a decade. I've been doing research on the Tor network for the better part of the last 6 years. So I've been dealing with various aspects of Tor, and in this talk, I'll mostly focus on usage of Tor onion services, that's what most people colloquially refer to as the darknet. Spoiler, you'll get less information than you want, mainly because of the subtitle of this talk. I called it Why Science is Hard, and that will be a theme you will probably detect throughout the next 30 minutes. And to give you an idea of what I mean by why science is hard, I'd like to start with a simple example, and we start with a simple question. We all have various ideas on what the darknet is being used for, and let's start with a simple one. How much of it are marketplaces? You know, you hear stories of illegal marketplaces that trade everything from drugs to assassinations. And now, if you might be interested, imagine you're a politician, or imagine you are, I don't know, law enforcement officer, or a lawmaker, then you end up, okay, let's figure that out. Let's open Google Scholar, search for the question. Google Scholar spits out lots of results because lots of researchers have been trying to ask that question. And we start with the first one that throws at us 3% of the darknet are marketplaces. Okay, that's great. So now we know. We don't know about the other 97%. So maybe let's take a look at another study. Maybe they figured that one out too. The next one says 34% of the darknet are marketplaces. Now we have a little bit of a problem because the two numbers don't perfectly match, but what do we do if we get two contradicting results? We pick a third one. 50% of the darknet are marketplaces. At this point, it feels like an auction, like who offers more. So probably go with a fourth one, but now the number starts going down again. Now only 27% of the darknet are marketplaces. And just for good measure, let's throw in a fifth one. That one says 9% of the darknet are marketplaces. Note, I didn't make those numbers up. So all of those are published peer-reviewed studies. So all of those are real scientific contributions. But you might notice that it's kind of hard to draw a final conclusion from that. So if I were a lawmaker and I would be presented with those five studies, then I'd be stuck at scientists have no idea what they're doing, which is a theme or an opinion that has become more widespread, at least in my home country in Austria. We have some issues with people not trusting us scientists, and when looking at this, I can kind of understand why. So I think there is a point to be made that something here is fishy. And what I would like to do is to take the opportunity and explain how such obviously contradicting results can actually not be contradicting once you start reading in more detail, or in other words, all the things that make science both hard when you do it, as well as when you try to interpret it, which often makes conclusions about things hard. And before I do that, I have to add a tiny bit of Tor knowledge. So I will assume that you roughly have an idea how the Tor network works with, you know, you start Tor or the Tor browser, and then you type in some URL, and then hopefully no one can figure out what you're doing on the internet. So far I'll expect you to know that, or I hope most of you are familiar, but there is one teeny tiny detail that gets interesting when we're talking about onion services. Number one, they're easy to identify, they end in .onion, so that part is easy. And what's important is that if a client, so if our green friend over there wants to connect to an onion service like Facebook, he somehow needs to figure out, okay, who should I talk to figure something out or to talk to Facebook? And since he can't talk to Facebook directly, because that would defeat the whole purpose of Tor, you need to take an indirection step via the Tor network. And to bootstrap that whole thing, you have to talk to a place called the Hidden Service Directory, where your onion service first publishes some information and says, if someone wants to talk to me, talk to that guy first. It's kind of, you have an introducer. So you need to go to someone else, and that someone says, okay, I'll allow you to talk to my boss or to my friend. So there is like an indirection step. What's now funny is this hidden service directory is like, spoiler, everything on the Tor network volunteer operated, and I'm a volunteer. So I can actually read. Thank you. So the cool thing is now that means if you are in the Hidden Service Directory, you can suddenly start reading everything that is being uploaded. And if you're a not so friendly person, you can also start tracking everything that is being downloaded. And if you do that, then you start learning a little bit about the Tor network. Most importantly, you can learn who is uploading something, so you will never figure that out, or hopefully, but you can figure out what is being uploaded. And in our case, we can figure out, okay, Facebook core www.onion is being uploaded. So now I can connect there myself and take a look at that website and check what's going on. There is, however, a caveat, and there's some of you that are a little either younger or more familiar with the Tor network might have realized that that domain, that Facebook core www.onion, is suspiciously short, because this is actually an old Onion address, a version 2 Onion address. Tor did change those a couple of years ago for two main reasons. Number one, they wanted to mess up my slides. But aside from that, they also changed how things are being uploaded. So now you can see if you are taking the new Facebook blah, 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 I'll not finish that word because I have no idea whether it's humanly possible to pronounce it. But the fun thing is we are uploading something else. So at this point, if I'm still part of the Hidden Service Directory because I'm still a volunteer, I don't actually know which Onion addresses are being uploaded. That has been a massive change to the Tor network with the switch between version 2 and version 3 Onion services. And they did that exactly to stop people from figuring out what's going on the Tor network, because now the only way to connect to a service on the darknet is if the operator, so our friend in blue here, actually tells us the address. If we don't know the address, we can't connect there, and if we can't connect there, we will never learn what the web server would be serving. And that has, for interpreting our results, one very important distinction. We have old results that were using version 2 Onion services. They are not functional anymore. They were sunsetted in 2021. But before then, for version 2 Onion services, you could figure out every single Onion address on the darknet. So you could literally go and connect to every single system on the darknet and just take a look what's happening there. And researchers did that. So that really happened. If you're taking a look at then, there was an intermediary stage between 2017 and 2021. There were version 2 Onion services and version 3 Onion services. And at this time, you could figure out all the version 2 Onion services and some of the version 3 Onion services, but you could never figure out all of them. And then later on, you could figure out only something about the version 3 Onion services and nothing about version 2 because it didn't exist anymore. So at this point, our results are actually different because one half was taking a look at the whole set, and the other one was taking a look at just a sample, and that has significant implications. Now, you could argue that the old results are now more interesting because the old results were taking a look at everything. The problem, and you could blame the Tor project for making my job harder, is that they've been very successful. So there is way more version 3 Onion services than there were version 2 Onion services. To give you a reference, in 2014, there were about 40,000 version 2 Onion services in total. And today, we are talking about somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million Onion services running. So the numbers have multiplied by a factor of 20. Yeah. So as I mentioned, great for the Tor network, not great for me, because now I have a lot of Onion services that we know nothing about. So old results are interesting, but they don't tell us everything. So we need to focus on newer results. And for newer results, we just have to take a look at which Onion services we can find. And that gets us to a very important thing, and that is choosing our sources wisely. Because what does an innocent researcher do who wants to learn something about the darknet? He has to go and say, okay, where can I get a list of Onion addresses that I can connect to and check what they're actually being used for? And the easy thing is you can just type into Google list of Onion addresses. I think today people would use ChatGPT for that. So my guess is that that would be the modern approach. I tried that I think a few weeks ago, ChatGPT is terrible at it, but maybe I'm just not paying enough money. So it might be a financial issue, but we will see. Then other researchers go and take specialized search engines, Amia being the most well-known one. Amia just easily gives you a set of onion addresses that it regularly scrapes from other sources. So that is one of the, in my opinion, better sources. But Amia has an interesting property. Amia filters certain onion addresses which it knows are illegal, mostly child pornography or child abuse websites. So that means if you take their list of onion services, you do get a set of onion addresses, but you get a filtered set. So there is certain parts of the darknet that you will just, by definition, not seeing when that is your data source, because you need to, and you need to factor these things in if you are later on interpreting results based of such study, based on such studies. Then you can go the other direction. You can take a look at GitHub. GitHub has plenty of sites. GitHub has also interesting properties because, number one, GitHub search is super annoying, which causes weird respects on what the GitHub code search will actually turn up. But most importantly, and what I find both funny and difficult to handle, is that GitHub keeps mostly track of two sites of onion addresses. One, it keeps track of onion addresses that are used in some forms of distributed networks, so everything related to networks, blockchains, and so on, bootstrapping addresses for everything from, I think I found even I2P services that use bootstrapping onion services, which I find kind of funny, but other story. And the other half is all the ransomware monitoring in the world. So everything, every ransomware gang that operates an onion service will eventually end up at GitHub, so you can also get a set of onion addresses there. And surprisingly, that gives you, or unsurprisingly, that gives you a focus based on onion services that have certain impact. So Amia filters something, GitHub has a certain type of address that is likely to show up. If you want a completely different one, you can try certificate transparency logs. That will give you a lot of onion addresses, and all of those are websites that have been able to purchase a certificate, which means they are probably not websites that care very much about their own anonymity. So Facebook, for example, is easy to find. Proton Mail and others would show up there. So if you want to find only legally unproblematic ones and probably fewer marketplaces, that is an option to go by. And that makes an interesting thing where you have to be aware, depending on which source you use, you could already kind of predict the results. So when I'm reading papers, one of the first things I'm checking is, okay, where you're getting your data from? And I've turned this into somewhat of a game of predicting the results based on just figuring out which data source we're initially going with. And it works, as I mentioned, in certain ways. Another aspect that gets then very funny is when researchers go ahead and say, okay, I've taken a look at 20 or 30,000 onion addresses, which I got from GitHub, for example. And then they go, okay, in total there's 800,000. Of my 30,000, 15,000 were marketplaces. So I'll now assume that of the whole 800,000, there have to be at least 500,000 marketplaces. So you just extrapolate and assume that everything works. And there is a problem that I think marketplaces actually explain quite well. If you were to start a darknet marketplace, then you need to enable people to connect there. So you'll probably share your address with other people, you'll probably put it on websites, on aggregators, and so on. So you'll try to make it as easy as possible for people to find it. The same applies to, as I found an even worse degree, to websites that try to scam you. Because scammers are fully aware that as soon as you, if you don't find them easily, then you probably won't find them at all, because they need to be the first one you find. So scamming websites are also trying their very best to be absolutely everywhere. So they're clouding everything. And the assumption that I haven't found any, so they have to be here, at this point, extrapolation actually becomes, well, at the very least, a daring assumption. Let's put it very politely, because running a web shop or a scamming website that nobody can connect to feels like a bad business model. I'm not a business major, but that feels like a bad approach to run a business, so I would expect that to at least not be the majority of users. Might be wrong, but don't really think that that is the case. And with that assumption, we can actually start answering the first question. You remember when I had one of the studies found 3% and the other one found 50%? Well, it turns out that they were just having that exact misunderstanding. So one of those studies was going with, okay, actually I observed 5%, and 50% of my 5% were marketplaces, which was 2.5%. And the other one found, okay, we observed 7%, and they found 3% were marketplaces, and one of them referred to what they had observed compared to the overall availability, and the other ones just extrapolated and assumed that everything else will probably behave the same way as our sampling data. And then suddenly you can have two results that at the first glance look like they're completely different, with one saying 50 and one saying 3%, and then you realize, actually, their data does agree, so the data is consistent. We were just not very good at interpreting it, or we have a disagreement on whether extrapolation is possible at that state, yes or no. And that is one example where we have an issue. Another one are definitions. Now, I will very intentionally try to avoid any definition of legality or illegality, but that in itself is super fun if you just try to figure out how people decide whether something is legal or illegal, but I'm avoiding that discussion. But super interesting is, what is a marketplace? Just try, now you can quickly think about it in your head, what defines you, what tells you what a marketplace is? And then how do you teach that to an algorithm? I know today you wouldn't, you'd throw it into an LLM and we'll see whatever pops out, but in the old days we needed to write our own algorithms for that, and there you can get very different results. Some people say a marketplace is everything that uses a web shop CI with, there's a basket, I can add products to there, I can click order, I can create an account, while others say every website that has the word buy on it is a marketplace, which makes everything a marketplace. So just by going with definitions, you can, again, widely iterate depending on how much you capture and how much you don't. I think one of my favorite definitions I had was a paper that assumed, okay, every website that contains the words boy, girl, and hot is child abuse. Just that. You check for three words. If I think it had boy, it had either to be boy or girl plus hot. Those were the three words. At this point, everything becomes child abuse. So depending on how you go with definitions, you can really create lots of things, whatever you want. So definitions are important, and they're also very important when you're trying to compare results, because otherwise you'll invariably get something. You can argue whether researchers are using that to skew data in one way or the other. That is one possible explanation. The other one is just that they found it very hard to actually properly distinguish, and then they just figured out, let's do it quick and easy, because paper deadline is approaching, which is also a reasoning I can at least sympathize with. With that out of the way, we need to account for something else. That is one problem that researchers have to acknowledge. We are human, and humans make mistakes. So the slide to the left of you, so the first one, is a blog on the Tor project, which was written by me. And the blog was wrong. Not just a little bit wrong, but quite wrong, because it turns out math is hard too. That is a talk that someone else should probably be giving. But what I can tell you, and this is a little bit complicated, but try to follow me, if you need to multiply something by 4, don't multiply it by 4 twice, because that gives a different result. So that is the very short... That is the very short gist of it. So it turns out my data that I published on the Tor blog in 2021 was off by a factor of 4. Fortunately, Tor Metrics reproduced my numbers and figured out, okay, you are wrong, and they published their own numbers, And then I felt really bad, and I said, okay, I'll fix that, so I'll redo my calculation. And then I redid my calculation, and then the numbers on Tor metrics didn't add up. So I made the mistake of taking a look at their source code. Turns out they're also wrong. Not by as much as me, so I was wrong by a factor of 4. They're off by 10 to 15%. There is still the to-do on the source code that acknowledges that we are still using the calculation from version 2, even though we are currently working with version 3. So they are fully aware what to do and what to change. They just never got around to. So turns out that one is also off. But we're not that much. So as I mentioned, we are not. So I thought when I first read it that they should be off by about 20% according to the source code. But then some researchers reproduced it. And they said it's more 10 to 12%. So maybe there is more than one to-do, and I just spotted one. So I'm not making any statements there. Still, be aware the numbers you get published there are also not entirely correct. So we're all human. We all make mistakes. And to a certain degree, we need to factor that in. That is why in science we like to reproduce and validate our results to each other, which, again, the Tor network sometimes makes hard because it keeps changing. That is also something. Social sciences are aware of that. It's very hard to repeat a study when the thing you're studying has changed. So that makes it difficult for us to actually confirm or deny our results, and that is also sometimes a challenge. But enough about my complaints. Let's try a little bit of what's the rough state of knowledge that we have on how the Tor network looks like. Number one, the hidden service directory is still our best source because it still tells us how many there are in total, and we can check how many can we find with using Google, AMIA, every other method that comes to mind. And you can see we can roughly find up to a third of everything that's being uploaded. So there's two-thirds we have no clue about. And that is all the published science I'm aware of. So maybe there are some people in this room who have top secret information and know more. But at least to the best of my knowledge, that is roughly the state. So whenever someone talks about the darknet, we talk about the one-third that is known, because we don't know about the rest. Based on the old studies from the version 2 era, probably a third of the unknown are botnets, just based on old results. But that's a guess. We actually have no data to confirm or deny that. If anyone is running a version 3 onion service botnet, please let me know. I would very much at least like to know how many there are, then I could put a lower bound on how many are at the very least botnet clients. I'd find that interesting. And there is some parts that we will realistically never know. Everything that falls onto Onion chat app and Onion messaging apps. So if you, if what's it, Briar, Ricochet, what's Kutch? So there's a series of apps that use Onion services for communication. Those addresses are never published. So realistically, you can guess or estimate how many there are, but we don't know. So that we don't know. But we can actually cut down on our size of unknown or on our quantity of unknown by not taking a look at uploads. Because it turns out when we want to know what the darknet is being used for, maybe the downloads are more interesting. And maybe it's even more relevant to take a look at successful downloads. Because, spoiler, there's a lot of failed downloads on the darknet. I'm not sure who is sending all those failed download requests, but some programs are probably very busy running into errors all the time. Or some humans are. Then there are some very patient human users who keep trying a service that has been offline for months, which seems intriguing. But if we take a look at successful downloads, then we can cut down on a few categories. We can easily figure out what's all the services that are also available on the ClearNet. That is your Facebook, that is your Pornhub, that is all the websites that you are familiar with that are difficult to access in some parts of the world, but not in others. So those you can easily put a number on. You can also put a number on blockchains, notably Bitcoin. Bitcoin has a significant share of all Onion service usage. So when you're talking about the darknet, pretty much all the studies I found should have acknowledged that there is way more Bitcoin nodes than there is marketplaces, child abuse sites, or whatever else they found, just because The benefit of Bitcoin is you can find all of them because the blockchain records all the onion service names, so it's fairly easy to connect to them all. That should also be acknowledged, so that's the reason why their share is relatively big. And then we have the areas that we can easily attribute, for example, all the ransomware part, and all the part that we just don't know but could connect to. So that is the light red part on the bottom, which would enable us to actually take a look at what is going on here. And that pretty much limits what we are able to do or what we can... But that gives you an idea of where we currently are. So research might turn up more onion addresses. We might just figure out better ways to estimate things. What we need to be aware, and that is one of the things I want to highlight, there's a vast majority we just don't know, and the Tor network is designed to make sure that we won't know in the future. That is just the nature of, or that is how an anonymity network is supposed to know, and you have to be aware whenever you're doing studies, you're working on limited and selected information, and interpreting that limited and selected information is not as easy or trivial as most people would assume, and that makes it hard to compare studies. Unless you take a look at them in detail, you need a lot of context to interpret, and at least to the best of my knowledge, LLMs are not capable. That was the last thing I did in preparation for this talk. I wondered what various LLMs would throw at me if I asked them the question of how many marketplaces there are and referred them to the various studies, asking them to summarize. LLMs have, as far as I can tell, one very simple degree that decides which study is credible, and that is, has it been cited by the BBC? So that seems to be the metric I could figure out. There is one, they all agreed on the same number. That number comes from a BBC article that cites a study, that was done in 2012. So that is that was the approach on how information was being parsed. So that is one of the things we have to be aware. It also has the interesting, noteworthy observation. Sometimes knowledge is not important in what researchers build, but in what journalists and other media interpret from it. And with that, I'm done. So I think we can move on to the Q&A session. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this interesting look into different studies and approaches. Are there any questions? Could you please go to the microphone behind you? Yes, microphone number one, please.
Yes, hello, thank you for the talk. If there is a company intranet, on which of the segments in slide 10 would it end up in? A company intranet, which you can't normally access from the outside. Mm-hmm. I guess it's not a part of the ClearNet.
No, it wouldn't be a part of the ClearNet. I would, in this case, refer to it as I would add it into the darknet category. But you should be aware that if you run an onion service, it connects to the Tor network, and that means it would be connected. So it wouldn't really be internal on a company internet anymore, because at this point you would have exposed it to the wider internet. So that's why I would just add it to the darknet category of a non-public server that is reachable from the internet.
The question from the cyberspace, please.
Yes, you have some fans on the internet, and they are astonished about how you managed to have such a good talk while walking 10 kilometers on stage. But now we come to the question, and this is a question not from the internet, but from a postcard to be read during the Q&A session of the talk mentioned above.
Who knows?
So Chaos Post, let's go. First, lovely presentation. Thank you so much. I was wondering if you have advice for a peer reviewer working for scientific journals on how to better recognize potential research methodology issues like the ones you talked about. Thanks, a listener not from the internet, but from the postcard.
Okay, haven't had that before. Well, I think there is plenty of people who are capable of catching those. There is probably, so if you're looking for qualified ones, then the Tor project is a good source of people who is bundling those capabilities. To be fair, there is probably a certain degree of bias there. So I mostly talked about things that made that makes interpretation of results hard. In terms of scientific methodology, there's a bunch more things to look at, but I won't be recommending any individual reviewers, so I'll back out of that question.
All right, Mike six, please.
Thank you for the nice talk. First, it's really nice that there's not too many people, so I can ask more questions. If you go back to the previous slide, please, of the not the right graph.
Yeah.
Is it describing the first third you have on the uploads, for example, the node?
I'm sorry, what do you mean the first?
What is the second graph actually referring to? Is it a total of all?
Okay,
excuse me, I misread that. It's the downloads, I'm sorry.
Okay, sorry, the second graph refers to just successful downloads. I filtered it on successful downloads because my assumption would be, so what I was trying to do was to estimate onion service usage. And uploads essentially measure onion service existence. So there's a whole debate to be had on what you want to measure. Do you want to measure all the uploads? For example, run an onion service that I just use as a back channel to SSH into my personal machine, which is used once every or twice a year or something. So there are onion services that are, in my opinion, irrelevant for onion service usage. So that's why I focus on downloads. And then I found out that more than half of all downloads fail. So that's why I came up with the metric of usage requires someone to actually establish a connection. And at the very minimum, that has to be a successful download. That doesn't mean that the connection was successful. It just means it didn't fail at that point already. So that is why I used the approximation of successful downloads.
And how easy is this to actually read the content of the packages that go through your relay?
Okay, so what I did, I first talk to the Tor project. They have a research safety ethics board, so I actually told them that I wanted to gather this data because I wanted to do it in a safe manner. Then I had a plan on what to do if the police raids me. I had a plan on what to do on how to store the data, mostly how to add noise to my data to make sure it is not useful for any police investigation or something. That saves me a lot of trouble and also protects Tor users. So there is a bunch of prep work that you have to do in order to do this ethically and responsibly. And then afterwards, the technical part is I added two lines of code to the Tor basic source code that just essentially adds another log statement and then compiled my own Tor binary and started that one and let it run as a relay. So the technical part is the easy one.
I just mean, can you actually...
Thank you. Is that a new question? Because there is also another person who wants to ask a question.
Yes,
it is a new question, then hold on to it. Okay. Please, microphone number one.
I think this was just cleared up. Maybe I just wanted to... It's maybe a clarifying question. So which of that data that you presented in terms of uploads and downloads is data you got from running stuff yourself, right? And what did you run it on? How much of it did you run?
Okay. Yes, so I mentioned at the start, I am a Tor relay operator. I operate 50 Tor relays, which constitute about 1% of the entire hidden service directory. And the hidden service directory is designed in a way that it randomly assigns me a share of its load every day. So I essentially see one random percent of overall onion service uploads and downloads, and I aggregated those over the... Oh, that I should have mentioned. This is data for 2024, 1st of January to 31st of December 2024. So that is the data of all the uploads and downloads I saw. And according to everything I know and according to how the implementation works, that is a random 1% share over 1 year. And I did the same thing, I extrapolated. To the best of my knowledge, that should be fine. But if Tor's random number algorithm generator is somehow flawed, then it might not be. So full disclosure, there we have assumptions again.
Thank you very much.
The question from the cyberspace, and then microphone six again.
RCA asks, how do you know using a hidden service directory that a download has failed?
How do I know that? Because the Tor network, the Tor requires you to upload and download descriptors naturally. And if an onion descriptor has never been uploaded, then if you're trying to download it from one of my relay can't provide it because it doesn't know it. So what I'm recording is just if I'm sending back a 404 not found because the relay you're trying to download doesn't exist. And that I know because I'm the node currently responsible for answering. I hope that clarifies the question.
Microphone number six, please.
The question before was probably just a little too complicated in the way I said it. Basically, when you get a successful download and it goes through your relay, all the bytes go through your relay, mm-hmm. Can you just read it? Like, can you just get the data?
Well, I can get the data, but the Tor project has with version 3, that's what I mentioned, the data that they are uploading is encrypted. So all I have is a random identifier that is generated with key blinding. There's a lot of cryptography in there that I skipped to not scare everyone off. And so I do get an encrypted blob uploaded and an ID for that encrypted blob. And the client takes the onion address. That's why it got so long, because it contains a key that you do key blinding and some cryptographic magic. Then you get an identifier, and then you send a download request for that identifier. And all I do know, this identifier was uploaded and downloaded. But if I know the onion address, then I can act like a client and also generate the identifier. And then I know this onion address identified created this identifier, and then I can go back and match, okay, this identifier was downloaded this many times or was uploaded this many times. That's the method on a very, very short Q&A appropriate timescale.
So, microphone number three, please.
Thanks for the great talk. I wanted to ask, with regards to like other anonymity networks such as I2P, is it possible to do like a similar degree of enumeration? And if so, can it be assumed that there's going to be a similar spread of service types out there?
So, to be fair, I've never looked into I2P. I2P, what I can tell you is, it in comparison, it is barely used. So I do have, for example, contacts in law enforcement that said they don't care about I2P at all because it has zero users. At least that's their opinion. I'm sorry for all the I2P people in the audience, but that is your public opinion. That is the opinion from Austrian law enforcement, which probably doesn't mean much to you. You could do it. In theory, it would work in similar ways, but I2P has a few advantages and disadvantages. If you want to, we can talk about that in more detail, but that would probably be beyond the scope for this stage right now.
Okay, the final question from microphone six, please.
Yeah, as a final question for the beginning of 2026, Tor, how many percent of the relay servers are currently hosted by, let's say, suspicious hosts that actually try to extract the data? For example,
I can tell you
government.
50 are mine that are extracting data. So that is what I do know. Unfortunately, other people who would be doing that don't tell us. So you can do the reverse. Go to the Tor Relay Operators Meetup, take a look at every one of them, see if you think they are, and then otherwise just keep check them off the list and see how many you can't identify. That might be an approach. I have no idea how we would figure that out, and I think that goes the same. If they do some major screw-up and you can tell they are doing something malicious, then they are thrown out of the consensus. But for those that behave normally, it's realistically impossible to say.
So, thank you very much.
Sorry.
Yeah, so maybe one final question from me. If someone has more questions, how can they approach you? Do you have contact details you can show for a final time?
Yeah, I should jump back to the final slide. I'm still here all event. Just call me on my DEC number. And if you don't want to talk to me but still have something interesting to share, my email address is on there as well. So just reach out. I'd be happy to know, especially, as I mentioned, if you happen to have some data on any other distributed networks that use Toronian services that I might not be aware of yet, I'd be very happy to shrink my gray numbers. So I like numbers going down, not numbers going up. So in that regard, if anyone can help, I'd be grateful.
All right, then, let's thank Tobias.